So good afternoon, Presiding Officer DeShane and members of the board. My name is Beth Callahan, and I'm the project manager for the proposed project. And listening with us is Mike Parker. He is a project manager with the Department's Bureau of Remediation and Waste Management. At this time, I would like to provide you with an overview of NORIC's proposed pipeline system. The pipeline system would consist of one wastewater discharge pipe and two seawater intake pipes. The pipeline would run from a common building at the Upland Development Site across US Route 1 over a 40-foot wide construction easement area on the Eckroat property and then extend into the coastal wetland. From the shoreline, the outfall pipe would extend approximately 3,700 linear feet, and the intake pipes would extend approximately 6,400 linear feet. Roughly the first 2,700 feet of pipeline would be buried beneath the seabed substrate, and the remaining 3,700 feet would be exposed and elevated approximately 12 inches above the seabed. Construction of the proposed pipeline would occur within a 100-foot wide construction area along the length of the proposed pipeline route. A 30-foot wide trench would be excavated in the coastal wetland to bury the pipeline. And to accomplish this in the upper and mid intertidal areas, NORIC proposes to use equipment operating on construction mats in small sections at low tide. Within the lower intertidal area, construction of the trench would continue using a barge-mounted crane with a closed dredge bucket for a distance of approximately 1,250 feet. The remaining work within the subtidal area would occur by sinking pipeline segments and anchoring them into place. And NORIC has proposed a construction window of November 1st to April 1st. So although I'm not going to go into detail here, this slide provides you with much of the legal framework that is relevant to the proposed pipeline system. With regard to water quality, NORIC collected two depth composite samples known as sample B3 and sample A6-A7, and these samples were analyzed using the rule of 20 technique. The rule of 20 technique is commonly applied for gathering a baseline characterization for toxicity levels for certain parameters, including mercury. NORIC's analysis indicates that the sediment in the two samples was non-hazardous. In specific regard to mercury, the concentration level in sample B3 was determined to be 267 nanograms per gram, and the concentration level in sample A6-A7 was determined to be about 103 nanograms per gram, which is less than the laboratory boarding limit. During the course of the board's review, interveners expressed concern that disturbance of sediment from construction would introduce mercury and an unreasonable amount of turbidity into the water column and negatively affect the water quality of Belfast Bay. Interveners also expressed concern that NORIC sampling protocols were insufficient for determining mercury contamination levels at the project site, and interveners requested further sediment testing. The Bureau of Remediation and Waste Management reviewed NORIC sampling methodology and the results of their sediment analysis. And the Bureau of Remediation and Waste Management commented that NORIC sampling techniques are an acceptable method to gain a representative depiction of the substrate's chemical composition in the area of the proposed pipeline. The Bureau also commented that the proposed removal of excavated material during construction is likely to result in an overall reduction and the amount of mercury contained in the coastal wetland. And as a precaution with regard to water quality, a possible condition requiring additional sediment testing and details of dewatering locations is offered in the Land Bureau's memo. NORIC has acknowledged that construction of the pipeline would temporarily disturb marine sediment. For this reason, NORIC proposes several erosion and sedimentation control measures, including working in small sections at low tide, operating from construction mats in the intertidal area, insulation of a turbidity curtain in the subtidal area, use of a closed dredge bucket, and limiting the hoist speed of the dredge bucket. These erosion and sedimentation control measures are based on best management practices, many of which are outlined in the department's BMP manual for designers and engineers. The BMPs in this manual are measures that have been determined to be an effective means of minimizing sedimentation. As a safeguard to assure that adequate erosion and sedimentation control measures would be implemented and that water quality is not unreasonably impacted, a possible condition requiring monitoring of pipeline installation by a third-party inspector at all times is offered in the Land Bureau's memo. Nordic's Natural Resources Report characterizes the coastal wetland as containing salt marsh vegetation in the upper intertidal area and then transitioning to cobbles and mudflats. Mobile finfish such as smelt and herring, in addition to clams and lobster, are known to be present in the project area. Interveners expressed concern that construction of the proposed pipeline would negatively affect fisheries in Belfast Bay due to exposure to mercury from sediment disturbance. The Maine Department of Marine Resources reviewed the proposed project in regard to wildlife and fisheries. And DMR stated that during the proposed construction window, finfish and lobsters would not be present in the area and that the pipeline would not restrict movement of lobsters. DMR also commented that the proposed pipeline would not adversely impact the marine resources in the Belfast Bay area. As I referenced earlier, Nordic proposes to excavate a trench approximately 1,250 feet long in the lower intertidal area. Approximately 36,000 cubic yards of sediment would be excavated from this area, and of this estimated volume, approximately 15,000 cubic yards of excess material may be generated. Nordic stated that excess material would be hauled to Mack Point in Searsport. And from there, the spoils would be transported to Crossroads Landfill or Juniper Ridge Landfill for disposal. DMR held a public hearing in March to consider public comments about proposed dredging activities at the public site, or sorry, at the project site, and its potential impacts to fisheries and the fishing industry in the area. DMR updated its comments following the public hearing to include a summary of the testimony and the potential impacts to the local fishing industry as a result of the proposed dredging activities. During the course of the board's review and at DMR's public hearing, interveners expressed concern in regard to disruption to local fishing activities and the loss or entanglement of fishing gear from transportation of excess spoils. The Bureau of Remediation and Waste Management reviewed Nordic's proposed disposal method and commented that this method to excavate and dispose of excess marine sediment would not result in an unreasonable adverse effect on the natural environment or public health. Based on comments heard at its hearing, DMR suggested several measures to minimize adverse effects on the local fishing industry. Some of these measures include marking the pipeline location, providing advance notice of construction to the local Lobster Zone Council, equipping the towing barge with a vessel monitoring system, and providing a mechanism for compensation of lost fishing gear during hauling of spoil material. As a precaution to assure that the proposed transportation and disposal activities do not disrupt local fishing activities or risk the loss of fishing gear, the board may wish to consider requiring Nordic to adopt DMR's recommendations. These measures could be required in the form of permit conditions, and possible conditions are offered in the Land Bureau's memo to aid the board in its review. And now at this time, staff are available to assist you with any questions in regard to this topic.
Thank you. If you can remove the slide as well, we can all see each other. Also, if there are any members of the staff, of DEP staff, who aren't expected to answer questions, I have a request from a board member to shut off your video so that board members and the active parties sort of pop to the top of our Zoom screens. So go to the board for questions, and I see that Mr. Draper has one.
I have several, but I'll start with a couple maybe and then let someone else take over. So one of my questions is this. There was a lot of discussion, or there's been some concern expressed by the interveners about mercury being released into the water during this dredging process, during this excavation process. And I noted in one of the conditions that, one of the conditions was that there would be additional sampling of this sediment and analysis of that sediment, but primarily that was due to determine the appropriate disposal of those dredge spoils at a landfill. I haven't seen anything where the DEP or the department staff has concluded one way or another whether excavating these sediments would have any impact on the water quality, you know, in terms of mercury. Can anybody maybe touch on that, please?
Mr. Parker is listening with us, and I think he provide some helpful information for your question.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Draper. To answer your question, your initial response that yes, we just were characterizing it for the purpose of disposal is correct. My program doesn't address the water quality issue of, you know, stirring up those sediments. And I was, as part of my review, man, I was trying to thread the needle between, okay, characterize the sediments as they exist using the totals analysis and balance that with the landfill receiving facilities testing requirements determining it's not hazardous. So certainly an analysis of using the totals analysis shows you what's there in situ. And then they also have to follow that up with the TCLP analysis to satisfy the receiving facilities. So, but I can't answer the water quality issues related to the actual excavation of the dredge spoils.
Mr. Livesey is in?
Well, I wanted to clarify for Mr. Draper, I think how the department's looking at this from a water quality perspective. And it begins with looking at the sampling that we do have, the relatively low concentration levels that are there, and that's sort of providing us with some level of comfort with regard to how that might sort of translate to water quality impacts. We're also obviously relying on and looking to DMR and its review of what the activity that's proposed there and their expertise in this neck of the woods as well. And then, you know, we certainly proposed, or didn't propose, but offered for your consideration several different conditions that I think speak to the water quality protection. So that's something we're obviously focused on, whether that's the possibility for there being, you know, third-party inspectors to deal with, you know, siltation and whatnot. And looking at the further testing that might be done as part of the upland disposal, just to make sure that the sampling that we have to date, which we think is going to be representative of the pipeline area in general, holds true. So you sort of put all those pieces together, and it helps us think about the potential impacts to water quality.
So just kind of quickly follow up. So there's probably
Mr. Draper, could I answer? Could I add some more?
Sure.
Yeah, in the course of my review, I did look at the sampling that was done in 2006, 2007, and also part of the 2013 as part of the Penobscot mercury studies. And there was a couple of sampling transects that ran across from Lake Belfast Harbor across to Cadenstein, and another transect that ran pretty much bisecting the town of Owlsboro. And the two samples that Nordic provided the results for were within the ranges of the two samples, transects that were done as part of those studies. So there was there was definitely some consistency in the results that Nordic provided and the previous work that was done that provided at least a level of comfort. But we also at the same time acknowledged that some additional sampling needed to be done prior to disposal anyway. So we would capture that information as part of our sampling and analysis plan.
So there's what I would hope for, and apparently, and I suspect it probably doesn't exist, would be some sort of correlation that could be drawn between a contamination level in sediment and what you might expect in water as a result of the excavating of those sediments. And apparently that there is no correlation available. We're not able to make that correlation then.
I don't think so. I mean, other things get factored into it are the organic carbon content, because mercury has an affinity for the organic carbon content in the soils and the sediments. So it can get pretty complicated.
Okay. Thank you.
Looking for other questions from the board? And if not, I'm going to dive in with mine. Seeing none, I need to better understand the divergence of opinion between what the Penobscot River study did for its mechanism for studying the mercury content of the sediments and the rule of 20, which is described as being a fairly standard procedure for doing it. I think the argument I'm hearing is that because of the way that mercury was deposited coming down the river from Holterkam, it's all in the very top layer, or most of it is rather close to the top. So if you do a fairly deep core sample, the entire core may test just fine, but that top centimeter, inch, whatever, may be pretty bad, and you don't capture that with the rule of 20 if you did it by a segmented study of the soils going down. Am I understanding that correctly? Is that how the department looks at it?
In my review of the 2006-2007 data, the samples that were done along those transects, they did the top 3 centimeters of the
right.
Sediments. If there's a proposed condition, we would look for them to do stratified sampling, discrete sampling, not composites, along both the horizontal and vertical depth of the sediments. So we would have discrete samples, not composites, across the full 30 feet of depth.
Because what we do have right now, for the originally proposed pipeline route, and it's relatively close, is composite samples, not
correct.
Stratified.
Yeah. Yep. So we would not accept the composite samples. We want discrete sampling across horizontal and vertical profile mm-hmm. of the pipeline.
Yeah, because the other testimony I think we heard was that, there's deposition across the entire bay. It's not serious contamination the way it is higher up the bay, but that it's not even either. There is, because of currents and stuff, there are some areas that are hotter than others. And so you have a double whammy of not having composite sample and a sample that was taken not exactly on the route they're intended to go on.
Correct.
Okay, so there is some question about how robust the studying was for the particular route they're going to be doing.
Yeah, again, that's why I looked at the existing entire body of data, not just what Nordic provided, so that we'd have some sort of a foundation for our review and recommendations going forward.
Yeah, great. Other questions from board members? Yes, Ms. Lessard.
In terms of, I note here that a recommendation from DMR is to mark this pipeline. Is there a fishing prohibition in an area surrounding this pipeline? It's not a particularly deep area, so lobster gear, that kind of stuff, doesn't generally go down and stay in one place. It sort of moves around. So I'm just wondering what, if any, conditions are there on, other than it's marked, are there on the local fishermen who may fish in that region?
Right. You're right. There is, DMR did note that the area is closed for shellfish harvesting. There is no scallop harvesting known in that area. And I think they noted as well that, unfortunately, lobster landings aren't widely known. But it, in addition to marking the pipeline location, I think that speaks more towards navigation. For the fishing industry, they did request a mechanism to compensate for potential loss of fishing gear that might happen along the haul route to Mac Point.
Okay, and the other thing is that sort of the construction necessary, I managed Vinyl Haven. We had an underwater cable, 4 of them, that went from the mainland to North Haven to Vinyl Haven to provide power, and on a regular basis, they got hit, they got broken, they had issues on a, they were hit by scallop draggers, they were hit by ship anchors, they were, you know, there are any number of things. what sort of protection mechanisms are in place for this, these lines that are a foot off the ocean floor?
So they are secured by concrete footers spaced about 15 feet apart. And then, so as far as knowing the location at the surface of the water, they would have to mark that. But I'm not familiar with maybe the material used for the pipeline. But if you have any suggestions, I'm definitely willing.
I was just curious because it's a tremendously difficult and expensive piece of work to excavate pieces of cable, and these are 30 inches in diameter. Yeah, that I'm certain that has some insulation around it in terms of it would. Any piece of it getting hit by an anchor or anything that goes dragging through, and it could be depending on if it's the waste discharge pipe or the intake pipe, could have a significant impact on their operation. That it's a curiosity more than anything else, and only based on the fact that I've been part of an entity that had cables going across this bay, and there were issues. So if something's been designed into this to prevent that from happening, I just haven't seen what that may be in terms of that protection, because it would have a significant impact on the ability of these pipelines to work the way they're supposed to. That's just a question that there isn't an answer to, but it is a concern that I'm sure that they've probably addressed it. I haven't seen that, but I'm
not aware of a security system that's outlined for the pipeline in particular, but I can definitely understand your question, because you're right. As part of the Remipides application, I understand that there would be some monitoring equipment within those pipes as well that I'm sure are important. But, you know, like I said, I'm not aware of a security system that's been proposed.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I believe I have Mr. Sanford and Mr. Pelletier in the queue, and I'll go to Mr. Sanford.
Good afternoon. This is Rob. So we got the VibraCore report and photos and description of that. That suggests to me that the bay historically is fairly stable and there's not quite the depth of intermixing. Did you look at those VibraCores? When you look at those, do they raise any concerns? And the second thing is, since those VibraCore samples were taken, does it seem like it might be necessary, advisable to look at any of those in terms of mercury or other indications of contamination as far as that might pertain to putting in the anchoring for the discharge and intake?
Sure. So I did. Yes, I did look at those VibraCore samples that were submitted, and I view it as supplemental information to verify the information that and narrative that they submitted with their application. And given that supplemental information, I still think that a possible condition for further sediment testing. Could be considered.
Okay.
Mr. Pelletier.
I'm not sure if this is something that maybe Mr. Parker might be able to answer, but in concerns about marking the location of these pipes, and I understand a lot of the fishing vessels that are out there now, you know, we've got some access to pretty good mapping and GIS equipment. Not everybody uses it, so that's an understanding. But would the location be put on some sort of nautical chart that wouldn't be, that could be followed by most, you know, by most people out there that have access to that kind of equipment? Is that a reasonable way to handle location of this?
Certainly. That specific language wasn't outlined in DMR's recommendation, but that is definitely a reasonable thinking for further consideration.
Would a surface buoy, this is Mike Parker, would a surface buoy marking it as like a, you know, subsurface hazard meet that concern?
Wondering if there isn't you know, just having it on charts, because you know, more and more people are using you know, GIS on their boats all the time just to track their stuff, and it should be something that would be outlined for many but not all people that are out there, you know, fishing or working out there. So I mean, that's above and beyond the buoys. This is something actually seen on their charts.
Yeah, to the extent that buoys may be a navigation hazard for the people who sail boats in there, which is probably the primary use, I think buoys could be a bigger issue than the pipeline underneath, but I'm not an expert to qualify a statement on that. Mr. Pelletier, did you have more, or Mr. Draper then?
Yeah, I guess one of this is just a continuation of my earlier question. It's just a confirmation of my understanding on the proposed conditions that are in the memo. Condition number 3, again, is the one that requires additional sampling of the sediment along the actual pipeline route. And just to use, kind of do the what-if scenario, my understanding then is that if during that process they, you know, it's discovered that there's mercury contamination much higher than what would have been expected, you know, based on the information we have to date. The only consequence of that would be to limit the ability, might maybe to limit the disposal of those dredge spoils. That would really be the only consequence of finding high levels of mercury along that pipeline road. Is that correct?
No, in the memo, there's additional suggestion wording in there that would also, for further contingency purposes, we would want to see more updated plans, updated erosion sedimentation control plan, a revised transportation plan, a revised disposal plan, updated construction method, updated construction sequencing plan.
Okay.
I'll jump in here as well. So the verbiage that you see there,
May I interrupt long enough to indicate this is Mr. Livesey who's speaking for those who are on the phone?
Oh, yeah. Thanks. The language that you see in the possible conditions is not language that we're recommending for you folks. It's really language that we put together because we thought that it spoke to topics that warranted particular consideration would be helpful in the course of this deliberation. And so one of the things, I think, one of the concepts that was intended to be captured by the condition that we're talking about now is the sediment testing, is that it goes right to what you're just saying, Mr. Draper, and that is, so what? And I think our thinking is, and the wording obviously would need to be worked out if the board gets to issuing a permit, but the concept is, that some appropriate steps would need to be taken in response to sort of elevated numbers. We're not necessarily anticipating that that's likely, but it could happen, and it's certainly prudent to be prepared. And then it is, well, what are those numbers? Because depending on what those numbers are, it might dictate what it means for going forward with a project and how construction could or couldn't be done. And so there's a balancing act, I think, in any permitting decision, in any condition like this, and that is, leaving enough room to be flexible, to be responsive to the results that you get, but not being so open-ended or to, you know, not have the structure and review that you want in place. So that's the, I think your question gets to balance that, know, we're thinking through, and we certainly welcome all of your thoughts on that as well.
If Mr. Martin, you seem to have unmuted. Did you have something to add, Kevin Martin?
Yeah, earlier on, I was going to follow up on, hopefully everybody can hear me. I've had mic issues in the past, but I wanted to follow up on one of Beth's comments directly regarding kind of the safety of the pipeline along the route. Just to note that we do have in the record comments from the Coast Guard recommending just such a measure. So it would be something we'd likely recommend with some sort of condition, which would be to work with NOAA to add additional charting and labeling just for precisely those types of measures. So.
I'll go to Ms. Bensinger next, please.
I'm just following up on Ms. Callahan's and Mr. Livesey's discussion of the potential condition number 3, and would note that that sediment testing, if a permit were to be approved and that condition or something along these lines were to be incorporated, it says prior to the start of construction. So the sediment testing wouldn't be as the project was going along being constructed. It would be done prior to the start of the construction. If the worst case scenario were to be revealed in this more detailed sampling, the permit, as Mr. Livesey said, the permit condition could read, you know, the project might have to be redesigned somewhat. So I just wanted to emphasize that language. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, you're still on. Do you have anything else to add?
No, that's all I had at that time.
Okay. Quick question for me then. When we got the DMR report, they were pretty much focused on the dredging, the hauling, disposal, and all of that, and the actual activity of the dredging and moving the material as it affected fishing. They deferred to the Army Corps of Engineers when it comes to the actual content of what might be dredged and what the impacts may be. So they didn't really rule on that or even really investigate it much. Also, it's not really part of DEP's protocol, as I think I heard about 5 minutes ago. Your department doesn't necessarily do a lot of that either. So what role does the Army Corps of Engineers play in this if they have jurisdiction over this?
So I can speak a little bit to that. The Army Corps process is a federal process, and it's separate from ours. While they look at similar natural resource impacts, their process is separate from ours and follow different statutes and laws.
I guess the point I'm getting at is, what if there's more mercury there than we realize because we didn't do a stratified sample? When you start to disturb that, the mercury flows down with the silt and contaminates lobsters a mile or two down the bay, and we never saw that coming. Who's responsible for it, for seeing that possibility and doing something about it ahead of time?
I think that in our application of Natural Resources Protection Act, that's one of the types of impacts that we're shooting to avoid. And I think the Army Corps is doing the same thing. And so from an applicant's perspective, they probably feel like there's an awful lot of overlap. From the federal government's perspective, they feel like they're doing their job. And from the state government's perspective, we feel like we're doing ours.
Great. Ms. Lessard?
The MAC point, I noticed that excess dredge spoils would be going to MAC point for transport to either Crossroads or Juniper Ridge. I would assume a dewatering site would be necessary prior to transport. Is that a separate permitting activity at MAC point that will be necessary in addition to this, or is that all get wrapped into this if this is approved?
So that would be a separate activity. However, we would want to know, it would be nice to know those location details.
Who, I sound like an owl, who does the permitting of a dewatering site for dredge spoils?
So depending on the location, it may require a permit under the Natural Resource Protection Act, or depending on if there are any existing licenses at Smack Point, maybe potentially other amendments to those licenses.
So Smack Point is a general area, not a specific location at this time?
Right. Yes.
There's been no identified site at Smack Point where this map X lot Y on Smack Point is where these are going and be dewatered, and then they go to Crossroads or Juniper because those are the options. So would it, if a permit were issued, would it need to contain conditions that encompassed the permitting of such a site and the receptiveness of the receiving body, depending on what was discovered in the samples that were taken along the way? I'm just trying to think of through a process that if there's not an identified site, I would assume that there have been conversations with property owners at Smack Point, but if there's a permitting process, I can remember some highly controversial permitting processes at Smack Point over the course of my life in terms of, dredge spoils. So I'm just wondering if how big or small an issue this could be in terms of another permit that's necessary that has a public process and all of those kind of things related to this.
Sure. Would definitely be something that to review and consider it. But as far as how big of an issue it would be, unfortunately, that's not something I would know right now.
Well, no, I agree with that. And there's not a way to know it, but I'm thinking through if a permit were issued that there would need, I would think, to be some language that acknowledges the process that is associated with that additional permitting for a dewatering site and upland transport and all that stuff. Now, 15,000 cubic feet is not 100,000, so there's that, but it's still a piece of this application that doesn't have a current location. You know, Smack Point is Smack Point, but it's not a specific site.
Can I clarify something? I think I was under the impression that the interveners have been claiming all along that the applicant does not have all its permits, that they need a separate NPDES permit for dewatering. And the applicant has been saying, and I think the department has been saying, no, it's all included under these current NPDES permit that we're going to be looking at later on. Do they need another permit that they don't currently have and haven't applied for?
I would suggest that maybe Scott or Laura might speak to that. There was some discussion about whether a separate NPDES permit would be required for dewatering that would occur in the ocean. There wasn't a discussion that a separate NPDES permit would be required for dewatering on the land. Scott, did you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Kevin's written a memo on that, I think, too. Kevin Martin, analyzing that from the department's perspective. And I think there are a couple, Kevin, you're muted for one, but I think there are a couple things to distinguish here, too, that might be helpful for the board. And Kevin can speak to that NPDES question. But I would anticipate that when somebody excavates this material, it's a contractor, and the barge operator takes it away, and ultimately it goes to a landfill. You know, just like we don't license the landfill as part of reviewing Nordic's process, if there's some intervening dewatering location that a third-party private contractor is handling, that's probably, I would imagine, that's handled outside of this permitting process. And a permit may or may not even be needed, depending on the nature of the facility and so on and so forth.
Right. There may not even be a permit, any permit right. necessary on the part of right. anybody.
Right.
If it's on the land.
Right.
So I'm happy to speak to portions of that if need be here. But my understanding here and my memo was based upon the idea of potentials for discharges falling under MIPTES. The central issue there was essentially the two federal regimes for sections of the Clean Water Act, sections 402 and 404, and which ones potential discharges would qualify under. So here, when we're talking about potential discharges that would be, you know, relevant over the water during construction, we're talking mostly about 404, which is discharges of dredged spoils. So when we're talking about dewatering, you're talking about potentially discharges of dredged spoils, which would be regulated by the Corps. I think one issue of confusion here would be kind of the transport and potential activities at Mack Point, one, and then also that interaction of 404 with the Natural Resources Protection Act. So what we have here is, since this is regulated under the Natural Resources Protection Act, we would still consider some of those federal activities within that kind of water quality construct that we're concerned with. When we're talking about Mack Point, I think there's some confusion regarding specifically the facts of this construction project and where the dewatering would take place. I'm not aware of any planned dewatering at Mack Point. I think my understanding of the application was that upon transport to Mack Point, there'd be specific methods, including sawdust for one, that would enable the transportation of this material at Mack Point directly to the dump trucks, which would be taken off to the landfills without the need of dewatering. If there were dewatering at the site, I think we would want further information on that, such specific locations, so we could monitor under NERPA whether there are any water quality considerations that we need to be aware of. Does that answer questions, I hope?
I believe it does, at least my question. Any other?
That's very helpful, Kevin. Thank you.
Great. Any other questions from the board or from anyone on staff? Seeing none, any further discussion from the board on what we've heard so far?